Today, May 20th, is Eliza Doolittle Day. It's taken from the character played by Julie Andrews on Broadway and Audrey Hepburn in the movie version of My Fair Lady. This is the kind of unofficial holiday that only musical fans would know about, but commentator Mark Aceto thinks there are good reasons for us all to observe it.
In Act One of My Fair Lady, Eliza Doolittle, the Cockney flower girl learning to speak like a lady, fantasizes about meeting the King of England. Of course, because it's a musical, she sings, "One evening the king will say, 'Oh, Liza, oh, thing, I want all of England your praises to sing. Next week on the 20th of May, I proclaim Liza Doolittle die.'" Since I'm not Julie Andrews, or Audrey Hepburn, or Marnie Nixon, who sang for Audrey Hepburn in the movie, I'll spare you the rest. But suffice it to say, Eliza envisions all of England celebrating her glory. However, the only people who recognize Eliza Doolittle Day are musical theater geeks like me. And while an evening of cocktails and show tunes is always fun, well, it's always fun to me at least, it's insufficient to mark the occasion because Eliza's message is all too relevant today. You see, My Fair Lady is based on George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, and both pieces explore the ramifications of learning how to speak properly at a time when elocution was valued as a symbol of education and upward mobility. Emphasis on the was. Listen to Franklin Delano Roosevelt say, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," and it's almost inconceivable that ordinary Americans trusted someone who sounded like Thurston Howell III from Gilligan's Island. We are now in an age when Sarah Palin speaks to a quarter of the electorate, even though she talks like she's translating into Korean and back again. Even the rhetorically gifted President Obama has felt compelled to drop his G's while trying to sell health care reform. I myself have heard college graduates say things like, "Me and him hung out," because apparently "he and I" sounds pretentious. Well, me thinks you just sound stupid. Nowadays, sounding folksy has become more important than sounding educated. As Eliza's teacher Henry Higgins says, "Use proper English, you're regarded as a freak." But our country's biggest competitors are learning proper English, and judging from all the Indian call centers, learning it quite well. Our country was built by people striving to move up, not dumb down. So on this Liza Doolittle Day, perhaps we should all take a moment to think before we speak.
Mark Aceto is the author of the novels How I Paid for College and Attack of the Theater People. He'll celebrate Eliza Doolittle Day tonight at a party in New York with Marnie Nixon.
Next week on the 20th of May, I proclaim Liza Doolittle Day. All the people will celebrate the glory of you, and whatever you wish and what I gladly will do. Thanks a lot, King, says I, in a manner well bred, but all I want is Henry Higgins Ed. Done, says the king with a stroke. God, run and bring in the bloke. Then they'll march when
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Lynn Neary. An independent scientist says the Gulf oil spill appears to be even larger than he had previously thought. That's based on video the U.S. Senate released Tuesday showing a dramatic gusher of oil coming from near the well's ill-fated blowout preventer. The scientist announced his updated figures yesterday at a hearing on Capitol Hill. NPR's Richard Harris was there.
Steve Worley went from being a respected but little-known engineering professor at Purdue University to being the center of attention last week. His claim to fame was producing, for NPR, a startling new estimate of the size of the Gulf oil spill. He said the flow coming out the end of the pipe could well be 10 times the size of the official figure. He used a well-established scientific technique called particle image velocimetry to measure flow from the largest of the three leaks near the seafloor. Worley has now analyzed the video of a second leak, and at a congressional hearing he said that leak alone appears to be bigger than the official estimate of 5,000 barrels a day.
What I get is 25,000 barrels a day coming out of that tiny hole. That's a 1.2-inch hole, and it seems incomprehensible that so much oil would be coming out of that hole.
But Worley says the oil in this part of the pipe is under tremendous pressure. Add to that last week's estimate of about 70,000 barrels a day, and his total is now approaching 100,000 barrels a day. And there's still another leak he hasn't even analyzed yet. Worley's flow rate includes both gas and oil, so he says his figures may come down once he sees enough video to be able to quantify the amount of gas.
But from what I see in the videos, I don't see them coming down, the numbers coming down that significantly.
Congressman Ed Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat, called Worley to talk to his committee. Markey noted the huge discrepancy between Worley's numbers and BP's off-quoted guesstimate, which is based on a survey of oil on the ocean surface.
What is the likelihood that BP is accurate?
I don't see any possibility, any scenario under which their number is accurate.
Worley told the committee he would like clean video from BP and lots of it in order to sort out how much of the flow is oil versus gas and to figure out if the flow has varied since it began nearly a month ago. BP has started to provide more video to a Senate committee, but the oil company rejected a plan that would have produced an independent measure of the oil flow. Richard Caminelli from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution told the committee he and a colleague had offered to put together an instrument that uses sound waves to measure underwater oil flow. He said BP was interested for reasons related to their broken equipment, not the environmental consequences. Caminelli said at 3 a.m. on May 5th he got an email from BP essentially giving the thumbs up. But then,
at 1 p.m. the next day, BP sent a message putting the project on hold.
BP said it was turning its attention to the containment dome. Turns out that didn't work, but even so,
our team was thanked politely by BP representatives for our efforts, and I've had no further communication with BP since May 6th.
Caminelli said he hoped to use the information about oil flow to help scientists measure the magnitude of a spill that's not only on the surface of the ocean, but also spreading deep underwater.
Understanding and knowing the total amount of oil that has been released is going to be critical so that we know how much was on the surface, we know how much remains subsurface, and we can track it and attempt to mitigate it.
BP's position all along has been that they're making an all-out effort to contain the spill, so putting a number on the outflow isn't a priority. Congressman Markey took issue with that.
This faulty logic that BP is using, of course, is unfortunately raising real concerns that they are hiding the full extent of the potential damage of this leak.
Markey scored one small victory yesterday. The Coast Guard told him he could post BP's live video of the oil and gas spewing out of the pipe on his congressional website. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The troubles in Europe continue to take a big toll on the financial markets in this country. Stock prices fell today for the fourth straight day. The Dow and the S&P 500 indexes are now down more than 10% from their recent peaks, signaling what investors call a correction. NPR's Jim Zeroli joins us from New York. And Jim, how bad was the damage in the markets today?
It was bad. And the amazing thing is it was really widespread. Of the 500 stocks in the S&P 500, all but three were down for the day. The Dow fell nearly 4%. Now, keep in mind that until now, stocks have been climbing really far for a long time. They've been doing really well. Now, in the space of about a month, all of the gains for the year have been wiped out. And if you look at some individual industries like financial stocks, mm-hmm. they're down even more. So it's been a really sudden and scary turnaround.
But we've been hearing for a while that the U.S. economy is improving. Why should trouble in Europe scare investors here so much?
Well, actually, there were signs today that the U.S. economy might not be faring as well as we thought. First-time unemployment claims were up a lot last week. But it does seem to be mostly about Europe. The fear is that because of this debt crisis, Europe could head back into a recession. And if you've traveled in Europe at all lately, you know there are a lot of American companies that get a lot of revenue in Europe, companies like McDonald's, technology companies like Dell and Apple, companies like Boeing. So they have a lot to lose if growth in Europe slows too much. And you're seeing that reflected in the stock market.
But it seemed not too long ago that officials of the European Union and the International Monetary Fund took steps to address the debt crisis. They came up with a bailout package that equaled $1 trillion. Why hasn't that calmed the markets down?
You know, it came late, and I think there's just a lot of doubt about whether Europe can control the situation now, whether it even has the political will to attempt to do so. One of the things that happened this week was Germany banned a certain kind of short selling called naked short selling, and it did this unilaterally. It didn't try to get the other European countries to go along. I talked to a trader today who said, you know, that raises questions about whether European countries are really working together. I think financial regulation in general is one of the things that's got investors pretty worried. In this country, as you know, Congress is working on a bill to overhaul the markets. And this, you know, might turn into a good thing in the long run, but it has a lot of investors kind of worried and uncertain about the future. And they're pulling their money out of the markets until they, you know, until they know for certain a little bit more about what's going to happen.
Okay, Jim. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jim Zirole in New York.
Roddy Doyle writes about Ireland, but not an Ireland of green fields and picturesque country pubs. His first book, The Commitments, was about young people from a gritty part of Dublin who form a soul band. It became a hugely popular film.
They call me Mr. Beautiful, baby, that's my name.
Doyle's new novel, The Dead Republic, is the final book in a trilogy about the fictional Henry Smart, a foot soldier in the Irish War for Independence. We catch up with Smart years later when he's working for the famous American movie director John Ford. Ford's best known for his westerns, but he wants to make a movie about Ireland, The Quiet Man, with John Wayne.
That humble cottage, who owns it now?
But the widow to land, not that she lives there.
Think she'd sell it?
Or do it?
I'll bet on it. Because I'm buying it.
Now, why would a Yankee from Pittsburgh want to buy it?
I'll tell you why, Michelin O'Flynn, young, small Michael Flynn, who used to wipe my runny nose when I was a kid. Because I'm Sean Thornton, and I was born in that little cottage over there. And I've come home, and home I'm going to stay.
In Roddy Doyle's novel, Ford promises Henry Smart that the Quiet Man will tell the story of his life with the IRA. But much to Smart's disgust, The Quiet Man becomes a love letter to rural Ireland.
John Ford created one of the great myths of American history and American culture, and he did the same with The Quiet Man for Ireland, a place that he loved, a place that he didn't know all that well, really, but like a lot of Irish Americans, absolutely adored the place.
Yeah.
It struck me as being Irish America's involvement with Ireland is a key point of Irish culture as well and Irish history. Kind of in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when Ireland was a bit of an economic backwater, we had to kowtow to a notion of what Ireland was in the hopes that tourists would arrive.
Henry calls The Quiet Man, this movie in particular, the emigrant's dream. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is there a lot of anger in Ireland about the way it has been mythologized by those who left it?
I don't think there's anger. I've been to the, you know, the location where the film was made. The beauty of the landscape is there. There's no denying it. And actually, it's very easy to slip into a conversation that wouldn't be altogether different from some of the conversations in The Quiet Man. I don't think people would feel anger. It'd be more, I'd say at this stage, amusement as much as anything else.
When Henry read the final script of The Quiet Man, the script that was actually made into the movie, he gets so angry that he actually wants to kill John Ford. Now, why so much anger about a movie?
Henry feels, I suppose, that he has wasted his life somehow. It's a life full of drama and escape, but really he's been running away from things most of his life. And I suppose he sees the film as stopping and turning around and assessing his life, the ugliness of a lot of the things that he did, he thinks is going to be an important part of the story. But what happens is that basically in the compromises, his life, the reason why he was involved in this thing, kept slipping off the page. And the whole tone of the thing changed from being a story which exposes the ultimate stupidity of the Irish War of Independence from his point of view, and the grimness of the violence and the reality of shooting somebody in the head, actually becomes a celebration of rural Irish life and a wonderful comedy that had nothing in common.
Well, eventually Henry decides that he himself wants to lead a quiet life, but in many ways the past catches up with him and he becomes involved again in the IRA, in the modern IRA. Give us an idea of what those years were like in Ireland, especially the 80s with the bombings, the hunger strikes.
things start getting ugly. At first he doesn't notice, but he's actually literally walking down a street in Dublin called Talbot Street, and a bomb goes off. And throughout the Troubles, very few bombs went off in Dublin. But I have vivid memories of this particular day because I actually heard the bomb. I was at home in a place where my parents still live called Kilbarrick. Myself and my mother were in the kitchen. I think I was literally just pouring myself a glass of water. And we heard this explosion. It was distant, but we knew immediately it was an explosion. But the bombing, the reprisals, the counter-reprisals, the kneecappings, all the ugliness, the horribleness was a daily part of the news, really. You could get on with your life, you could fall in love, you could, you know, get a job, you could do all the things that everybody does everywhere. But if you were Irish, you had to live with either trying to ignore the violence and feel guilty about it, or to confront it and feel guilty about it.
Henry begins to get drawn into the Troubles, and he starts to think that maybe little has changed. And there's a section I'd like you to read. It's on page 203.
Grand. Once I started paying real attention to Ireland beyond the parish, I realised it was 1920 again. Every stupid decision, every shooting, every rubber bullet, internment, Bloody Sunday, every strong rumour, British collusion in the planting of my bomb on Talbot Street and the other bombs that afternoon, all these sent young men and women queuing up to join. Approval was in the air, everywhere. The British were back, on the telly every night, taking over the streets 80 miles up the road. There were dead bodies, there were refugees, reprisal and counter-reprisal, terror and retaliation. It had gone on for 3 years, in my day. It went on for decades, this time, and it was still my day.
So much of this book is about clashing visions of Ireland. And,
yeah.
And in the end, an IRA man tells Henry that the war had always been about what it means to be Irish. He says it's about the copyright, the brand, as he calls it. I mean,
yeah.
Is that true?
I think so. In many ways, Ireland is a very self-conscious place because of, say, the Irish-American links, because we speak English. We seem to punch beyond our weight, so to speak, that who controls what it is to be Irish and what it is that we can be comfortable with seems to me vitally important. And it's happening again now in many ways because the economy, as you're probably aware, has hit, if not rock bottom, pretty close. And I suppose while the bankers and the politicians have let us down, culture really hasn't. And suddenly the power of books and literature and, to a lesser extent, I suppose, film has come to the fore again. My concern about that is that who's going to define that culture? Will it be us, the citizens of Ireland, who actually live there? Or will it be some sort of marketing department of the civil service who will try to define what Irish culture is in the hopes of enticing people to arrive and spend their money? So, you know, definitely when I was a kid, if you didn't speak Irish, you really wanted to. And you played Gaelic games and you didn't pay any attention to what was happening in the outside world because really Ireland was the centre of the universe. And I don't think that's the case anymore. Although, admittedly, it is the centre of the universe.
Roddy Doyle, his new book is The Dead Republic. Thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from Roddy Doyle's new novel, The Dead Republic, on our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
And joining me now to talk more about this development is David Rejeski. He's the director of the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and he studies public perceptions on scientific advances. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
As we just heard in Joe Palca's piece, there are concerns among the public about advancements like this. What exactly worries people when we talk about this?
Well, I think one of the problems that we have is because a lot of the applications, for instance, to energy production or medicine are, I think, many, many years away, the science tends to be judged by the public more on the basis of its morality and risks than its practicality and its benefits. So one of the things that we've done, we've run experiments and focus groups where we've actually tried to get people to talk about the science based on, let's say, producing cheaper fuels. And a lot of them will acknowledge that there could be benefits, but they also raise, I think, a number of interesting issues. One of the issues they raise continually is whether the science could lead to the development of biological weapons. Another smaller group tends to talk a lot about environmental impacts. They worry about, are we letting something into the society that 10 years from now or 20 years from now we're going to be sorry about? And then there's a small percentage who have a very, very strong reaction just on moral grounds. They think this idea of playing God really involves kind of crossing a boundary, and they don't think we should go there.
You know, as for those moral issues, are there other aspects of that debate that you foresee on the horizon?
I think what we talk about a lot less is the ethical piece. This relates to trust in our institutions and their accountability. I think this discovery comes at a rather unfortunate time in terms of the relationship between corporations, the public, and the government. It's right on the heel of the financial meltdown and the Gulf oil spill, and I think those have done a lot to redefine public expectations about both ethics and risks. And so there's a broader kind of narrative in which this discovery gets played out in, and I think quite often the scientists don't think outside the lab and realize that society is actually being impacted by lots of things that are happening in people's lives.
Mr. Rozeski, before we go on, I want to play some tape for you. We're going to hear President Lyndon Baines Johnson speaking in December of 1967. Let's take a quick listen.
What are you going to read about tomorrow morning? It's going to be one of the most important stories that you ever read, or your daddy ever read, or your grandpappy ever read. At this very moment, the biochemists at Stanford University are announcing a very spectacular breakthrough in human knowledge. They have, for the first time, finally succeeded in manufacturing a synthetic molecule.
Again, that was President Lyndon Baines Johnson, and he sounds pretty excited there by this advancement. Would you expect a similar reaction today?
I doubt it. I think that was 1967. I think people's attitudes towards science were quite different. I think at that point in time, if I remember correctly, we were 2 years away from landing someone on the surface of the moon. And I think the public excitement about science was very different. I think in the interim period, people have become more weary of claims from the scientific community. I think there's a number of constant narratives that get played out, and they get played out in popular culture. We see these in our movies. We see these in video games. One of them is that the science essentially slips over to the dark side and is used in nefarious ways. So I think people now, today, are very different, and I think much more suspicious about science and the motivations of scientists.
That was David Rozeski. He's the director of the Science and Technology Innovation Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Mr. Rozeski, thanks so much.
Thank you.